Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 442, which is a replay of a best of episode, one of the listeners' favorites from 2011 with my guest, Teresa Strasser. It's also one of my favorites. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. If you've never tried online counseling, I highly, highly recommend it. Just go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the /mental so that they know that you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire and they'll match you up with a betterhelp.com counselor if they feel that they have one that is a good fit for you. And then you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is right for you. And I love doing it. I love not having to leave my house to do therapy. And I love my therapist. And you need to be over 18, but I highly recommend it. I want to tell you guys about a podcast. We mentioned it last week, and he's been a guest on the show here. I've been a guest on his show, the Jordan Harbinger Show. While it might have a slightly different approach to the same goal that this podcast does, which is personal growth, it is filled with practical advice for not only personal growth, but professional growth as well. It's a Apple Top 50 podcast, and was among Apple's best of 2018. The Jordan Harbinger Show covers topics like, there's a guest who is an FBI hostage negotiator, and he teaches how to establish trust. There's neuroscientists, Navy SEALs tell us how to develop resilience and mental toughness, and amazing stories from people who have lived them, from crazy kidnapping stories and going undercover, CIA agents, illusionists who can seemingly program our brains, basically anything that will help you upgrade your brain so you can become a high performer both at home and at work. I think you guys would really dig it. And also, every episode has a worksheet, so you can make sure you're internalizing and applying what you learn from the guests. So you deserve to be extraordinary. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and start taking your life to the next level. And the URL for it is jordanharbinger.com/iTunes. Although I understand that will be changing shortly because iTunes is splitting into Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, and Apple TV. But if you go to jordanharbinger.com, I'm sure you can get more info. And it's JordanHarbinger. And here now is that episode with Teresa Strasser from 2011.
Everybody I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And sad.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
I'm here with Teresa Strasser, who I met, well, I guess it would have probably been about 6 years ago. You were Adam's sidekick on the Adam Carolla show on one of the FM stations here in town in Los Angeles. And we just kind of immediately, I don't know about you, but I just kind of immediately felt an affinity for you.
That was totally unilateral. I'm sorry. No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
You were having a rough day when I went in there.
Yes.
I think you and Dave Damashek might have gotten into it or something.
Was it that day?
Yeah, it was.
Oh my God, it was.
Yeah.
Wow. That, I mean, you
or it was within a day of that.
Yes,
but
that was a rough day.
It was, and you were trying to keep it together, and my heart just went out to you. And I think we had a little conversation in the break room, even though I didn't know you. I don't know. We just kind of clicked.
I remember this now. I think it's a recovered memory because that was so traumatic. And now I recall just a friendly face and also a male.
Yes.
Who wasn't, there was a bunch of guys there.
And I a were, very, very alpha male environment.
There were essentially no women. There was producer Angie and who's great, and me. And so it was really intense, and I've worked in all male environments a lot in my career, and I enjoy it. It's just something about that moment in time felt very much like I felt really vulnerable. And for people who don't know, which is probably everybody, because who gives a shit by now, but a male coworker on the Adam Carolla show, who I'm very friendly with now. That's all. What is it?
Water under the bridge. Yeah. Pus under the wound.
Bile under the bridge.
Yeah.
No, it's really fine. And it's just there was an unfortunate incident during a commercial break during our live radio show. And he's that kind of a bigger guy. Mm-hmm. And we kind of got into it. And he told me to go fuck myself. It was very unexpected and sort of I felt a little bit threatened.
Yeah.
And I was scared, but more emotionally, when someone yells at me, I just shut down. I just shut down.
And you were the new person in the
I was brand
on the
new.
Show.
Yes, I was replacing a woman who had been the sidekick, so I didn't really know anybody. And as it turned out, the producer had kind of stirred up a fight between us, because that makes good radio, and it worked, right? So there really wasn't an honest beef between us. It was like, did you say this about me? Yeah. Why don't you go fuck yourself? You know, it was that. And then...
And he was probably thinking that... Because if you say that to guys, that's a game that guys play. That's... Guys do that with each other. You know, we let the steam out. We bag on each other, and
right.
we get verbally aggressive.
Yes.
Some guys. Not all guys.
Well, I learned that on that job because, you know, I took a few punches, and at a certain point, a guy who worked on that show, Bald Brian, who was then the phone screener, he pulled me aside and said, look, if you weren't getting shit, that would mean no one liked you. That's
right.
How we do.
Exactly.
And I went, oh, this is you guys accepting me?
Yes.
It hurts a lot, but thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take it. And, you know, that was rattling because then we went on the air, and I don't know if anyone can relate to this, but I'm a crier. And what happens, it's very physiological. I can be sort of like you stub your toe, and then you know you're not still stubbing your toe, but your toe still hurts. Like, I'll get over something, and then my body is still crying about it. Like, mm-hmm. I can't, sometimes I...
It's like there's an emotion that lingers.
Yes, it lingers. So,
Your crying has a long, delicate finish.
like a
oaky,
wine.
Very oaky.
It has top notes of despair with a strong, pathetic finish. Some tannins. Yeah, so that's exactly it. It has a long, long, like a cheap red wine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that we went back on the air, and I knew I was going to cry just the way, you know, anything biological is going to happen to your body.
Like, you can feel it. Yeah. You can feel it coming, like a big shit coming on. You're like,
not
going to
stop it. It's not going to get out of its way. This thing is a locomotive. Yeah. And Denzel Washington and that other guy are on it, and they don't know how to stop it. So I knew I was going to cry. And in the back of my mind, I thought, I can go in the bathroom and save my dignity and probably save face, or I can just cry on the air, which is going to make this a better show.
Yeah.
And I knew I was going to cry, so I sort of chose to cry on the air because that was the more interesting thing to do. And it sort of changed that show, I think, because instead of it becoming about gags and bits, it became more about the relationships between the people, which I personally find more interesting and dynamic.
But, Me too.
So I couldn't stop crying. I mean, I think I cried for a straight hour on the air. And then this guy's mom called in to yell at him for being rude. And then Adam made him broadcast from the bathroom as a punishment, which was smelly. And it turned out to be an entertaining show, but I was devastated. Yeah. Devastated. Mostly because I was embarrassed about the crying, even though I did choose to cry on the air on some level.
But you didn't fake an emotion. You just decided when to let it out, which I think is an honest choice.
Was I
going to
be in the bathroom for an hour crying? I mean, once I start, I'm going to cry a long time probably. Yeah. Even after I feel better, and I knew it was okay and I was fine. I didn't feel that bad anymore, but my body was just going to keep crying until whatever was out.
Yeah. And I think I was there then the next day because there was a tension in there that was palpable, and you were still a little
fragile. Well, I got called
into
the boss's office. Do you want us to fire that guy? Because they were worried. They were covering their own asses, so they wanted to make sure I was cool,
right?
And otherwise, they were going to fire this guy because they didn't want me to say that it was a hostile workplace or any of that shit. And I said, I'm absolutely fine. And then I remember the next day my agent called and she said, do you want me to get you out? Should I get you out? Do you want me to get... No. There's no way.
That's the last person you want to be is also the person that if there's a problem, clear everybody out.
They sue or they go, whatever. Like, yeah. If you're going to cry on the air and it's at least going to be amusing for people from a Schadenfreude perspective, fine. But if you can't handle, you know, taking a punch, then you probably shouldn't be... doing radio, and I think I'm in a
certainly not an Adam Carolla show.
Yes, and I am in a I'm straddling because on the one hand I can take a punch, on the other hand it hurts like fuck. So it's not like I take the punch and go, well, whatever, I'm Lisa Lampanelli.
Right.
No, it hurts.
Yeah.
I feel it.
Yeah.
But I just keep.
And
doing
by the
it.
Way, she her feelings are always hurt after.
Yeah.
The
what
roasts.
Am I talking about? Yeah. That's not even a good comparison because she's actually really has a soft, chewy center.
Yeah. According to her, she does, which makes sense to me. I think most people that dish it hard do it because it keeps the focus off of them, so they don't get hurt.
I think that's why she can get away with it is because I think it's you sense on some level that she's not a malignant person. I met her a few times because she was a guest
super
on Adam's
sweet.
Show. Oh my God, the nicest and really open about her struggles, you know, with her weight and, you know, going into rehab for her weight. Just very open. And I love hearing her as a guest on shows. And I think she's really talented.
But let's get to you, Teresa Strasser.
Ugh, what a boy.
You have a book out called Exploding My Baby, which when I heard the title, I was like, I know I'm going to love this book. And I just finished it last night and I did love it. It is a great book. It's brutally honest. I can say assuredly there is nothing else like it out there. It is original. You craft some gorgeous sentences. I had no idea that you were the writer that you are. And you should be really proud of it. I hope you are. I know that you wish the sales were more than they are, but I think
great reviews.
5 stars
sales,
on Amazon, which
sales,
almost no books have 5 stars on Amazon.
That was really nice. And you know, the LA Weekly gave it a good review, and Vanity Fair made it one of their top picks, which for a pregnancy memoir is unusual. So that was really nice. But, you know, my heart was kind of broken because it wasn't a bestseller. Mm. And, you know, there's like the way I was raised, you get an A+ or, you know.
Go home.
Go home. What's the point? And even if you get an A+, that's what I expected you to
do.
Right. So good for you.
Let's talk about that a little bit because your childhood was not pretty. Your parents divorced when you were 3.
Yeah, 3.
And you were left in the custody of originally your mother, right? In the beginning, it was your mother.
My dad legally got custody, and that was very unusual then for dads to get full custody.
And why was that?
They just gave you to your mom because they just thought then, you know, this was in 1974. They just thought moms are better. Moms should have the kids. That was really the default setting in family court. And my dad got custody, which means my mom must have not really made a great case for being a parent.
Which makes sense as you read more of your book.
Yeah.
You.
But my dad gave me back to my mom. So my brother and I were in an awesome parenting move.
Right.
One of their greatest hits was they thought, you know what's great for siblings who are a year and a half apart and have never known anything other than being with each other all the time and whose parents are now getting divorced and moving to two different cities? Let's split them apart.
Let's put them each in a single housing unit. Let's put them in the shoe.
Let's put them in the shoe so that they can lose that sibling bond forever. And now we're like cousins. Yeah. I love the guy, but I didn't grow up in the same house as he did, so I'll never really have that. So what happened was my dad got us, and then he was overwhelmed. He had two kids. He was running. He's a mechanic. He was running a garage for, you know, 6 days a week, and he just didn't know. And then he got involved with my stepmonster, who was she was a monster. She was a horrible monster, and I've written plenty about her, and I won't bore people. But she can,
I don't think it's boring. I think people would want to know.
She was the fairy tale evil stepmother. I mean, she
Give us some slices. I always ask my guests.
How dark you want to go?
We go as dark as you got it on this show. The darker,
I might cry.
The better. That's all good.
Here is something I've only started talking about recently because it's really creepy and I get afraid to creep people out. But I told my husband the other day and he wasn't that creeped out. He was angry on my behalf and I like that. So my dad hooked up with Carol, who was 9 years older, and he was lost. He had two kids. He was 30 with a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. Running a business, and he just was lost. He meets this woman who's a lot older, and she's in therapy school, which to the day she died, she never completed. Mm. So she was always taking courses in becoming a therapist. So she had some sort of gravitas because she had taken some classes and she had read some fucking books. She had a lot of self-help books on the shelf. She had three kids. They were teenagers. They were already all fucked up. One of them's...
In the house with you?
When they moved in together, yes. The eldest, a real big guy, like 6'5", with schizophrenia, that was just coming on at that time. So that was pretty scary. And then two girls, one of which later became, for lack of a better, a crack whore. Mm-hmm. And the other one, married, lives in the suburbs, and she's just not very nice. But can you blame her? Because that was her mother. Anyway, she moved in, and she convinced my dad that he should give me back to my mom because she had been molested by her dad and she was an expert on human behavior because she took a class at community college. And she said she convinced my dad that because he and I were very close that he was in danger of molesting me and that she could see signs that the relationship, you know, was untoward. And so for my own good, he should give me back to my mom. And he was scared and he didn't know anything. Now, mind you, this kind of thing doesn't come out of the blue in a family, right?
Right.
A guy that has no history of sexual abuse, like that was never going to happen. You know, people in my family are really fucked up, mainly from bipolar and other kinds of Ashkenazi Jew things, but they don't molest each other. That's just not a thing they do, just like they don't drink. There's things they do, things they don't. So in my heart of hearts, I know that she, because she was molested by her own father, that to see a father and daughter interacting together and we were really tight, it just was something she couldn't have. So she had to get rid of me. And that was her way of doing it.
Wow.
She did it. I mean, she vanquished a 3-year-old.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's not hard to vanquish.
No. I mean, candy from a baby. But so then I went to live with my mom who had moved to Chicago. She moved back to take me when my dad, and it was going to be temporary. Like let's try this for a couple months. And then I never went back, mainly because I didn't want to be with Carol. But my brother stayed there and I went to live with my mom in San Francisco. And at that time, I hadn't seen her for 6 months because I'd seen her here and there, but she had moved away. And she was really, really a stranger. I didn't know who she was. I felt she was, and she's kind of just cold. She's not, she's not real maternal. She's not a hugger. So all of a sudden, one day, she picks me up. And I remember like driving away. And my dad always tells this story that it was the most heartbreaking moment of his life is seeing me look out the window with my pigtails, my freckles, and with just a tear, kind of like trying to keep my shit together. Because I didn't want to go with my mom because she was cold and weird and a stranger. And so I then...
you're leaving your brother.
Leaving my brother, you know, who was kind of violent toward me just because he was a five-year-old boy, but he was all I knew, he and my dad. And so I went with my mom, and I remember very distinctly being in, she had painted my room, and she, you know, gone to some effort, and she gave me some hot chocolate with marshmallows in it. And I was very happy about that. And then eating disorder for the rest of my life. So there you go. Here's some marshmallows. That's the only thing you have that's going to make this go away. You know who loves you? Marshmallow. That's it. You know what's warm? Cocoa.
Not mom.
You know what you can grab in your hands that's real? Cocoa.
You know, I just want to back up for a second because this is, I always like to compare notes and inject myself wherever I can into the podcast because it's my fucking podcast.
No, and that's what I like about it when you do that.
Yeah, but one of my favorite memories of my dad was a cold person. When people would come over to the house, my friends, like when we were, you know, 8, 10 years old, my friends would always say, "Why is your dad mad at me?" And I would say, "That's just my dad's face. That's just, he was at the end of the couch.
You had the scary dad."
He didn't express anger. He was just in his head. He was an untreated alcoholic who just wanted to shut the world out and be with his thoughts and watch the Cubs.
Right.
But he wasn't outwardly angry. He was just he was just shut off, just completely shut off. But one of my favorite things about him when I was a kid would be when it would be time to go to bed, he would carry me upstairs. And we lived in a two-story house, and I always remember, you know, he would be carrying me, and I'd have my arms around him, and as we'd walk up the stairs, there was this part where the ceiling got low, and I would always touch my hand on that part of the ceiling. And it was just a nice ritual. And he would tuck me in, and it was my favorite memory of my dad. And for some reason, he just stopped doing that, and I never understood why. And my mom told me years later that she asked him to stop doing it because she was afraid that he was going to molest me because his drinking had gotten worse.
Wow. Wow.
And I was like, wow, that's so fucked up that why she would extrapolate to that place just because somebody's drinking.
Where was she coming from, a family where that happened?
I don't know that she was ever molested. She came from a really, really fucked up.
Because you don't just come up with that idea. Like,
yes.
That's not an idea that would dawn on me about my husband or anybody else, because that's just not part of my story.
Right.
However, I think if it is, like, you spot it, you got it. You start to see it everywhere.
I think my dime store opinion is that my mom had, because my dad wasn't there emotionally, and I kind of became the savior, the fill-in husband emotionally, I think my mom had some feelings towards me that weren't appropriate. And I don't think they were ever conscious in her brain.
Right.
But my mom did cross a lot of boundaries with me.
With the touching your butt. See, I
yes,
listen.
Yes. And so, but it made me so sad that one part of my relationship with my dad went away for no reason. Like, the only thing he was doing that was good, that made me feel safe, got shit on.
And the ceiling. Like, kids need ritual so desperately, especially if you're living in a chaotic alcoholic household that I can only assume it was pretty chaotic. So even if it's just, I touch this spot on the ceiling every night, I need that.
Yeah.
That's the container that I can, you know, bump up against.
Yeah.
That's something that I can depend on. And also, whenever I see a parent carrying a child, there's just something so beautiful because the child is just limp and sleepy. And, you know, you only get carried a certain amount in life.
Yes.
And then it's over.
Yeah.
And then no one's going to carry you to bed unless you're, you know, passed out. Unless it's bad.
Right.
It's bad after a certain point if somebody's carrying you because you usually have one shoe.
Yeah. But it's the greatest feeling in the world, feeling completely enveloped and protected by a parent.
And
there comes a point where that you need to move away from that and grow up and be on your own and discover how painful the real world is and all that stuff. But it just kind of sucks when that gets needlessly cut short. So yeah. I apologize if that was a self-indulgent for me to inject that, but
Would you like me to pick you up right now, carry you, because my son's room got a nice crib. I will carry you and see you.
If this were video, I would absolutely, just to watch your knees buckle.
You'd be surprised. I mean, my son's really big. You met my husband.
He's a tall guy.
So my son's big for his age. He probably weighs like 37 pounds. I have no problem. That's why God gave women hips. Yeah. I just put them right on my hip. Mm. He always wants down. He always wants down because he wants to run.
Sure.
You know, but boy. I love carrying him. I could carry him on my hip all till he's 25.
Yeah. And how old is Nate? It's Nate,
two.
Right?
Yeah.
So getting back to, you went to live with your mom, and your mom she lived in San Francisco, and she was in the early feminist kind of.
It was like, let's talk about vaginas, let's be in encounter groups, and this is how groovy, okay? She owned a coffee shop in the Hate called Sacred Grounds. That's for real. And we had a beat poet named Max living in our garage for 10 years.
Who was huge.
He was huge. It's a real thing. Jim Morrison was his college roommate and took all this video of Max, the beat poet, and his girlfriend having sex. And that, for some reason, it's some sort of famous video because I think Jim Morrison was going to be a filmmaker at some point. Maybe they were at UCLA.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's how they met.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
What a small world.
Yeah, so my mom was supporting the arts by having Max live in our garage, but it's weird when you're a kid and you know like the garage door would be flung open and there's Max on his dilapidated lawn chair, couple of his teeth missing, you know, like a bad piano.
Really?
You know what I mean, where some of the keys aren't. Yeah, and then always doing the poems, so I'm coming home with a friend from Brandeis Hillel Hebrew Day School, where I was like a scholarship kid. And I'm coming home with a friend just like hoping nothing too weird is happening at my house. And there's Max. Snap, snap, snap. Look at you. You've got a friend. Two little girls. End to end. Snap, 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 snap. Oh, God, let's go, let's go. Nothing to see here. Nothing to see here. Keep it moving. And then that was unfortunately never the weirdest thing because my mom never wore pants.
What?
Whatever. Yeah, why should she wear pants just to make you comfortable? She doesn't feel like wearing pants in her house. She wore underpants, but no pants. Still does not wear pants.
Just undies around the house.
Have to ring the doorbell or knock and yell up the stairs, Mom, someone's here, put on your pants.
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. Hilarious if it's a sitcom character, but when it's your mom, not funny, not fun.
Some of the passages in the book that I found to be the most moving and memorable were you talking, involved transportation as a child. Can you talk about some of those?
Well, and for people who've heard this before, I apologize because we'll get to our fear off later.
Yes.
But one of my main fears is that people are sick of hearing about my sad childhood in particular.
That's okay.
Because since I've had a kid, it's been up for me a lot more. Mm-hmm. It's been thinking about it and talking about it a lot more. But I spent most of my childhood on various modes of public transportation because my mom just didn't want to give me a ride anywhere. She just wasn't interested in being a parent, and that was inconvenient and it was a bummer. And there was buses, so here's your bus pass or here's your Greyhound ticket.
And you're 7 or 8 at this age taking public transportation by yourself.
Earlier, I flew alone at 4. Because my mom was in San Francisco, my dad was still in LA, so I could see my dad. I would fly alone, which is no longer legal. And then I would take the Greyhound.
Also, it's now known as the Teresa Strasser Law.
Yes, like Megan's Law.
Megan's Law, yeah.
Yeah, because I was too emotionally broken. They had to make a law. Now, I didn't really know any different at the time. I don't remember it being that bad. And I don't even remember the Greyhound. I mean, I was scared when they would, because it was 8 or 10 hours, depending whether I went to LA or Santa Barbara where my grandparents lived. And I would get scared at the stops because that's where either people were visiting people in prison that's the serial killer belt of Southern California, mm-hmm. where the Greyhound bus goes. And it mainly stops near prisons and stuff.
Yeah.
So I was scared that I'd get off in San Luis Obispo or Salinas or whatever, and then the driver would announce, like, we're leaving in 45 minutes, and if you're not here, the bus is going to leave. So I would be pretty paranoid about getting stuck there. But otherwise, it's all I knew. So I didn't realize that, you know, I should be angry or scared. And I had I walked on a Greyhound, and I knew where to sit. You know, I knew, like, avoid that guy, avoid that lady. I wouldn't even be kitty corner to that guy. You don't want to be in his peripheral. Like, I just knew, you know, I had.
So you had an old soul by the time you were five, probably.
I think I was just savvy because I took the city buses around San Francisco. You know, I took the bus to school, I took the bus home from school, I took the bus to ballet. So I was on the Muni, that's what we call mm-hmm. it there, or the BART or whatever, real young. So right. I kind of knew the ropes.
Right.
Yeah.
And talk about the watching when it was raining. That.
Oh, I would beg my mom for a ride. Because in San Francisco, it sometimes get a few really rainy days. And to catch the 24 to Visadero to elementary school was up two giant hills. San Francisco, you know, you might have heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hilly.
A little hilly.
A little hilly. And so, and all my book bags, I was all studious and everything. It's like 90-pound book bag. And I remember just in the rain begging her just for a ride to school or for a ride just to the bus stop. No, no dice. No dice.
What did that feel like?
You know, just, you won't catch me on a bus now. That's for one thing.
Yeah.
I'll probably be giving my son a lot of rides. We'll probably be annoyed. I'll probably want to take the bus or the subway, even though no one does that here. But, you know, it was lonely. You know, it was lonely, I think. But on the bus, that was around the advent of the Walkman. So I always listened to the Alex Bennett radio show, which I don't know if you know who he is,
mm-hmm.
but he would have all these comedians on, who a lot of whom I ended up meeting doing Adam's show, like Bobcat and Bobby Slayton and
Kevin Pollak.
And he would have Robin Williams, all those San Francisco comedians. Mm-hmm. And they were my friends. They were my friends.
Yeah.
You know, because I would listen all the way to school through, you know, transferring buses and everything. And that's what I love doing. And to this day, I love, like, when I can't sleep or when I'm on a long drive or when I just need to relax, I love listening to radio or what are now really podcasts.
Yeah.
Just because it's just soothing. And I don't know, it's just a voice in your ear telling you a story.
And then you became an entertainer. Isn't it funny how a parent's neglect, while painful to the child, in some ways can often become a gift to society because that person... Because if you look at some of our favorite entertainers, they come from the most neglected, fucked up childhoods. And so then society benefits from having those people around to entertain them.
Well, if we were all well-adjusted, who would write the books?
Yeah.
Who would do the dark comedy?
Yeah.
Who would do the... You're right. You're right. Yeah. I know. Years of pain and suffering. Yeah.
So
but it can also kind of hurt, I think, your ability to work. At least for me, I've found that. Because, you know, I might have interesting stories and I might be willing to be very open about them, but I also have a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And that can get in my way.
Yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, we've talked about that on the podcast before. What an awful combination to be saddled with cynicism and imagination. You know, it's
right.
It doesn't get any more lethal than that, because it's wonderful when you're crafting a bit or you're writing a book, but you don't get to turn that cynicism and imagination off when you choose.
Or let me present you with this juxtaposition or whatever. Yeah. How about, I think a lot of us, or I'll speak for myself, there's a need for approval, and then there's paralyzing self-doubt. So how am I going to get your fucking gold star if I'm too fucking scared to go for it? So like when I was living in New York and I was working on a morning show called Good Day New York, where I was a field correspondent and I would do live remotes, usually outside the studio. Sometimes I'd be in the studio. And for the year I was there, I became the correspondent for a show called Good Day Live, which isn't on the air anymore. But you know they have Good Day LA with Jillian and Steve Edwards and Dorothy. I was their New York person, so I got to be kind of frequent on their show, where every week or every other week I'd get a call, and they'd say, oh, the Statue of Liberty is reopening. Can you go there and we'll just pick up a live shot? Or the American Doll store is a big thing, so why don't you go and we'll shoot you at a tea party with a bunch of kids. Or it's the Apprentice auditions. Go interview Donald Trump and then like try and, you know, sneak into the auditions. Or it's the Westminster Dog Show. Sneak it, right, try to run it, you know, right. That kind of thing, right? So I would have anxiety. I'd see the producer's phone number on my phone. That would be the beginning of this whole life cycle of fucking brutal anxiety. I would see the phone number. Now, you're supposed to be happy. Somebody's calling you because they want you to work. And this was a national show. It was a big deal. And I loved the people on it. But that became part of the anxiety. See the phone number, immediate stomach ache. Immediate stomach ache. And I'd be like, fuck. I wish they'd stop. I mean, I need them to keep calm. I'm so happy they like me, but I'm so desperately terrified of doing this. I don't want to do this. Please don't. Oh my God. So I pick up the phone. I force myself to pick up the phone because I've had a lot of therapy. And you just walk through it. You just do it. Just do it and feel horrible. Feel the fear, whatever, but just do it. So I take the assignment and then for, you know, the 24 hours until that live shot, I would feel so sick and I would overprepare. I mean, I remember doing a live shot from the Wax Museum when they had unveiling new statues or whatever. And I had jokes about every person in that fucking museum and I was so scared. And mind you, technical things do go wrong a lot. And I think that fed into it. Like, you know, your audio wasn't good and you couldn't really, you can't see them.
Your imagination is taking that where it's going to go. You know.
Right. But what really made it terrifying, and here, I don't know, this is, I have a feeling you'll get this, but what really made it terrifying is that after the first few, they would say things on the air, like Jillian in particular would say, oh my God, I love her. I shouldn't say this, but she's my favorite. She's my favorite correspondent. And Steve Edwards, who's the, you know, main male host, would say, oh, I love her. And then as soon as you like me, the idea that I could let you down or that you would realize that I'm actually not so great, that is really at the heart of the paralyzing fear. Because after doing it, you know, 10 remotes, it was obvious that I could do it. I had the skill set to not botch it. So it then became irrational. It then became about something different. It became about, like, I need to keep these people loving me because it feels so good. And I just want to leave that. Like, I wanted to do one, it would go well, and I'd be on a high, and I would think, great. Now, I never want to do that again because I just want to leave on a high note while they still like
me. And I'll never be able to recreate that. I just got lucky there because my core message that's instilled in me is I'm not good enough.
Right.
So and I really, it was a fluke.
Total fluke. Lightning in a bottle. And if I never do it again,
then I
can prevent failing and I'll not lose the, like, once somebody likes me or believes in me, I then, that really intensifies any sort of feelings I have. And I get really nervous sometimes doing Adam's show for that reason. Like, we had a year with Danny Bonaducci, and then, you know, he didn't come back. And then Adam called me at home, and he had a conversation, and it was along the lines of, you're really good. You don't know how good you are. Not many people have what you have. Blah, 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 nice things. Okay. As we're having
coming from Adam, who is not an effusive person.
Yes, right? And as it's happening, I'm like, oh my God. Like, I'm sweating from my armpits. I'm like sweating. My head hurts. My eyeballs start hurting. Everything is like, oh my God. I just want them to bring in somebody else because I don't want to be. And he's telling me, you can do this. You can be my co-host. I don't need Danny Bonaducci or anybody else. I just need you. You step it up a little bit. And fill in the gap.
Did you believe
and we don't
him.
Need anybody.
Did you believe him when he said you could do it?
I had known him never, ever to lie. Hmm. He's an incredibly honest human being. He doesn't have, he just is missing the piece where you sweet talk people.
But did you, I believe that you believed him.
I believe that he may, he, I really.
But did you believe that you could do it?
No. I knew I couldn't, 100%. I really thought, no, I can't do this. I don't have enough to say. I don't have extreme enough opinions. I'm probably annoying. I repeat myself. I'm going to interrupt or talk too little or talk too much. I mean, it was a carnival of fucking self-doubt. And I was so bummed that Danny Bonaducci left, which is something I've never really told anybody, because that whole staff, it was a celebration that he was gone. They really didn't, you know, nothing personal, but they didn't feel like he was, didn't really like his comedy stylings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they didn't feel like he was a good fit. And people were really happy. I alone was unhappy because I thought, great, now this is my moment to let down somebody who's shown so much faith in me and who I admire. Mm-hmm. This is going to fucking suck. And every day I would do it and it would be fine. And then I would spend the Greg Fitzsimmons. Do you know Greg?
Mm-hmm.
He had one of the funniest lines ever about this. I was telling him that every day after the radio show, I would drive home, and for the 20 minute commute home, I would just regret. I would go over the things that I regretted saying and then the things I regretted not saying. And this was every day.
I relate to that. And
he said, he goes, you know what you should do? Move closer to the studio. That's a practical fucking solution.
So you're in the car less, going over it less in your head.
I should have moved across the street, the street, and then I don't have, but just room. Do you do that too? Where you think,
oh my God,
did I say or not
constantly.
Say?
Every time I finish doing the podcast or going on somebody else's podcast, there's five things I want to call them and say, please don't air that. It makes me look foolish. Or I sound arrogant, or I sound, because I assume that the rest of the world is not out to love me or accept me. They're out to take me down.
Why do you assume that?
I don't know. It's not in a malicious, let's go get Paul, but it's in a, I suppose because I grew up in a household where there was some love, there was some praise, but mostly there was ignoring and there was criticism.
Right.
And plus, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm negative to begin with. I'm self-absorbed to begin with. So I think, you know, you've struggled with food issues, so I know you probably have those, you know, the three hallmarks of that all addicts have is self-centered, emotionally immature, and hypersensitive. You know, that's something that doctors, before they knew anything about alcoholism or the treatment of alcohol, that's one thing that doctors could agree on was all alcoholics show these three symptoms. And so I think that probably also extends to people that have food issues or, you know,
any
other
kind of
issues.
Addictions.
Yeah. And I think that's just kind of the coping mechanism for people that are addicted to, that want to escape that
well,
ball
that's
of.
Well, interesting because while I don't know you very well, you did come into the radio station, not just the one time where I was in the middle of one of my meltdowns, but a bunch of times after that doing your character.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, are we allowed to say, we break the fourth wall, that you are Representative Richard
Martin? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've talked about the character.
Okay, so you, and you know, okay, so you're one of these guys that everyone likes. Like, you have a warm, easy personality. And
this is news to me, by the way.
Really? Because you're just one of those people that I wish I had that personality. Like, oh yeah, everybody loves her. She comes in her room and I try and make people like me. I desperately try. I'm a lot better at it just because I've carefully monitored people who have that quality, and I just imitate certain facets.
Right.
You know, I simulate normal human
being. I would disagree because it really feels organic to me. You're somebody that I instantly felt comfortable around. So I think this is both you and I are just both in our heads. But
you really genuinely are a person that people like.
Yeah.
Because listen, I was in the room with all those guys, and believe me, when a guest came, and people weren't shy about, like, was that guy a dick? There was a lot of
really.
People would kind of voice their feeling, you know, you get a vibe what people think of somebody, and everybody always liked you. Everybody.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice to hear, but let's not make this, even though it's my dream, let's not make this all about me. So getting
back. Because you got that warm thing. You got a warm, open thing.
I appreciate
that. That's probably
my wife,
why I felt like I could talk to you that day.
Thank you. And that means a lot to me. And my wife would tell me that as well. But there were also people that thought I was an aloof dick. So it, I
really?
Think it depends. Yeah, it depends on what day you, you caught me on. But fast forward to you're living with your mom. You're into ballet. How does the eating disorder present itself? And it, at what age did the food issues become?
Well, I don't even remember not having it. And everyone's got a different story. But in my case, I can't think of a time when I didn't binge or starve, exercise insanely, become obsessed with how I was going to lose weight and what diet I was going to go on, feel very uncomfortable in my own body, and then right back to just want to get to the refrigerator. Like, I remember being at my grandparents, and my mom, because it was all hippy-dippy, she didn't have junk food, but my grandparents had would have Rocky Road ice cream in their freezer. So I remember I would go to their house for the summer and literally gain 25, 30 pounds. Like a kid. I would just fucking eat because it was unfettered access to shit. And
this is your mom's parents or your dad's?
My dad's. And I already had this. Like, so I would remember I would walk by with a big, giant spoon. And I'd tell him, I'm just going to have this one spoonful. Mm-hmm. And I'd have it. And I'd walk back around, sit in front of the TV. And I'd like, fight it. Next commercial yes. break. I'm just going to have one yes. more. Then you try to move the ice cream around in such a way in the container that it doesn't look like it's been attacked by fucking raccoons, right? And by the way, I spent a lot of my life manipulating food items to look like they yes. had not been attacked.
Yeah.
You know, like at one point, I had a job as a temp, okay? But it was a half dayer. So the temp agency calls and they go, this company's having their holiday party. They need somebody to answer their phones. Can you do this while they're out at their party half day job? No problem. So I show up there and I'm sitting there and it's dead slow because it's right around Christmas. No one's calling. And I notice there's a giant vase like up to my waist in the corner and it's huge and it's glass. It's filled with M&Ms, plain and peanut. Okay, plain and peanut.
Yeah,
both. You don't have to decide. You can. And so I think to myself, well, I will just have one or two, mm-hmm. or a little.
Do you say to yourself, "I'm going to have the peanut because then it's kind of like a meal"?
Oh, it's protein.
Yes.
Sure, that's healthy.
That's
healthy,
what I would tell myself.
Right, you go with yeah. that. Yeah. But even then, like I had a very precocious knowledge of calories because if you are one of these people, that's you're an expert. Mm-hmm. You know a lot of shit. About, but it's not about that. You know, it's a spiritual malady, which you are treating with food or starving or whatever. But you know a lot. So I already knew at a very early age that peanuts had a lot of calories. So right. I couldn't even really convince myself that it was healthy. But cut to, by the time they get back, I've actually eaten myself into like a coma. I mean, I'm out. I'm passed out like a drunk or like somebody nodding out
like
on heroin.
Like Miss Blankenship on Mad Men.
Yes.
Dead at the typewriter.
Yes, I was Miss Blankenship, but, you know, Miss Blankenships, whatever, you know. Like, I had eaten myself, you know, into, yeah. It
was, so they come back and you're asleep.
Well, I'm on the desk.
Because you've eaten so much sugar.
And the drool is, like, colorful, you know, because it's M&M yeah. drool. So I've got, it's hard to hide. And the, you know, the level of the M&Ms in the vase has moved down. So if you CSI it,
yeah.
You see the girl's passed out with the drool and the M&M vase is down. What the fuck? Kind of temp. But I was never really, really overweight because I would binge and then I would starve and I would binge and then I would starve. So
did you ever make yourself throw up?
No, I really couldn't. I'm not mm-hmm. a thrower upper. Mm-hmm. If I could have, I would have. I think yeah. I would have been bulimic.
It would have fucked your teeth up, doesn't it? The acid from it really screws your teeth up.
It really messes up it's really hard on your body.
And bad on your esophagus yes. and a bunch of other things. Yeah.
Yes. And I yeah. can kind of spot it now that I've seen it enough. Yeah. Like yeah. on your face gets puffy, cheeks are puffy.
Really?
Eyes, bloodshot. Yeah.
Like just from the...
Yeah. Yeah. Teeth, like you said. And it's really, it's hard on your internals.
Mm-hmm.
But I never did that. I just we would go on binges. And then I would starve and exercise a lot so that I could stay a normal looking, you know, as mm-hmm. general. There, at a point, I was probably 30 pounds bigger than I am now. There are points when I've probably been 10 pounds less than I am now, but this is kind of a normal weight, which I've maintained now for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So
your eating has not been out of control for a decade?
one day at a time. It has been.
That's fantastic.
Yes, it has been. You know, I have days that are imperfect and are sloppy, where I don't feel that comfortable about
right.
what I ate or how I, or my behavior mm-hmm. or with the how I ate it. Mm-hmm. But generally, and that's amazing because, like I said, I don't remember ever not having this kind of relationship with food. And toward the end, there were incidents, and this is, I honestly would feel better if I were talking to you about shooting heroin or doing cocaine or being addicted to gambling or any, this is the least glamorous addiction. And even in my own addiction, I would feel better if I were a bulimic or a flat out anorexic, because that's more glamorous. Because I thought nobody else, like on Valentine's Day, before I, you know, before this reversal 10 mm-hmm. years ago, I had this, was dating this guy, and I was doing a show on deep cable over at the Game Show Network, and the boyfriend put me on like a 1 week hold for Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day happened to fall during this 1 week. Mm-hmm. He said, let's take a week off.
Right.
And the guys on my crew went, what? That is so
the week
fucked.
Of Valentine's
yeah,
Day.
Yeah, what a dick, right? Yeah. So on my little host chair, they put a giant heart-shaped box of candy, and I'm giant. I mean, I don't know what in pounds, but giant. Mm. So I was like, oh, thank you, thank you. I'm starting to be a little nervous with it in the car. Take it home alone. Pour myself a little glass of wine with it, although that's not really my thing. But it's a good, you know, you're disinhibited. Is that the word? So first I think I'm just going to have the caramels. Like, you see how it goes. I'm just going to.
Caramels are always the first to go.
Yes.
You know, they're like the black people in a movie, you know, in a horror movie. They're going down first.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those caramels, they went down.
Yeah.
Right? They were gone.
Yeah.
And then maybe there's some like brittly things that might be good or something nougaty.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're getting to the fruits. Right? Mm-hmm. But each time I put the whole heart-shaped box back in the cupboard.
Absolutely. Otherwise you have a problem. If you don't put the cover on it.
Right. I know I'm that. I can't possibly eat any more of this.
Yeah.
But I'm alone and no one's seeing it. Now I'm into my second glass of wine. And now I'm getting into things that are orange and purple. But here's the thing. I'm only eating the chocolate around it.
Sure.
I'm not going to eat that orange shit. I don't even know that shit.
It doesn't
even taste
good. It's not good for you, Teresa.
It's not good for me. It doesn't even taste good.
Yeah.
Why would I binge on something that doesn't taste good?
Right.
Because only someone who does this kind of shit knows what I'm talking about. I would binge on oatmeal, broccoli. There's nothing I haven't binged on. But now I'm eating the purple and the orange and the cordial, which is the most disgusting.
Yeah. That's your bottom.
That's a bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's even as I'm saying this.
When you hit the coconut, you knew you needed help.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That is a one-step program.
Yeah.
Coconut. You're eating the coconut? Really? There's 100 pieces of chocolate in here?
Yeah.
And you're down to the coconut. That's what it's come to. Sometimes you feel like a nut. And you are.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah. So that's when you knew you needed help with
that. And then there was an incident. It's so embarrassing because it's like food. I mean, here people are starving
and I can't stop eating. You have to see Patton Oswalt's newest stand-up special because he talks about this exact same thing. He has food issues. And he talks about how lame he feels having that as an issue compared to alcoholics that have great stories.
I just want to be a drug addict, like a real... But
Trust me, you don't hear some good stories. Trust me,
no,
you
I don't.
Although the thing that I don't envy about you is, you know, there's this saying that you have to open the cage to the beast three times a day because you have to eat.
You can't just put the plug in the jug.
That, to me, is...
That can be tough.
That's scary.
And you know what else was weird? Well, I'll say to Patton's point, yes, it is very... It's a hard thing to talk about. And I feel like as a culture, when someone dies of this disease, no one says that. And I'm going to... Like, you're John Candy's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who clearly... was morbidly obese and he ate himself to death, right?
Yeah.
That happens a lot and no one says it. And I just think, why are we, everyone, that person's morbidly obese. They ate themselves to death.
Yeah.
If they drank themselves to death and had cirrhosis of the liver, we would all say that, isn't that too bad? And let's raise awareness. But when somebody, you know, and there are people I know who are 60 pounds, there are people who are 500 pounds. It's kind of the same thing, really. It's like, I'm going to control this or I can't control this. But yes, it's totally unglamorous. And there are things I've done. I've eaten food out of the trash. I've eaten food that was still frozen. I've eaten food that was burnt. I mean, my husband doesn't even know the stuff because he knows me. He only knows the me that's, you know, well into recovery. Yeah.
And the thing for anybody out there that's struggling with an addiction, the biggest thing that is frustrating, trying to cure it yourself, trying to solve it yourself, is the addict tries to control it directly, which can never happen. Because the real issue, as you know, is the anxiety underneath it that drives you to seek comfort by anesthetizing with a substance or a person or shopping or whatever it is. And the only way to cure that anxiety is through the energy of connecting to other human beings. And I know that people are tired of me probably on the podcast talking about you need to connect to other people, but that is, it's the truth. It's the only thing that I know that has ever alleviated my pain and my loneliness and my fear inside me.
Well, what else is there? There's nothing. I mean, if you peel everything back, and you know, recently I had an experience where that felt pretty extreme, where I got very, very down, and very down. And in that moment, I had clarity. Like, these are the things that matter. Doesn't matter. Like, my husband and my baby.
Can you be more specific about this? Because I heard the interview, and I know you probably don't. You talked about it with Adam, and it was riveting to me. And at the risk of burdening you with repeating the story, I think it's one.
Don't want to bore people. But
yeah, it's Teresa. It's anything but boring. And I think there's a lot of people that have been in that place where you have been, and I am one of them. I've been in that place before.
It was pretty bad. I mean, I think, like I said,
how long
ago
was this?
This was, God, I want to say I'm terrible with time, but I think maybe it was, let's see, I think the baby was 18 months, 99, about 5 months ago, something like that.
Or 1974.
Either
one.
One of the two. They both sound right.
It was a crisp day. That's the important thing.
It was a crisp fall day.
Yeah. In February.
And, and the birds were chirping. Well, I had been, so whatever, to make it concise, my sleep was off because for one thing,
you've been an insomniac your whole life,
lifelong insomniac, and doing morning radio. So getting up at 4:30, and my baby, you know, he's in daycare. And so he just, they get sick a lot. And he was just a condensed period where he was up a lot in the night and he was sick. And I felt incredibly guilty that he was getting all, I blame myself that he was getting all these colds and stuff because I was putting him in daycare because I was working. That was part of it. Part of it was I was simply, my brain chemistry was off just simply from not sleeping. After a few months of not sleeping, you start to hallucinate, which I did. I would hear him crying when he wasn't crying. I'd flat out fucking auditory hallucinations, right? So it started to get bad. And then I really thought, there's only one thing that can make this better. Like, I gotta go. This is like a party and I don't want to be here. I don't want to say goodbye to anybody. I will sacrifice my coat in the pile of coats on the bed. I will just sneak out the back and no one's going to miss me. I just want to go. I just can't do this.
I want to die.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I didn't want to upset anybody, but my brain was fucked up from not sleeping. And, and then the day that I, when it kind of came to a head, I was driving to see my therapist because I thought that'd be a good idea. Because, you know, having a baby and a job, you know, the amount of time and effort and energy and money that it takes for me to stay sane is a lot. And, you know, that was not a priority. So I hadn't been to therapy in months and hadn't been going to support group meetings as much and doing the things that were keeping me sane. So on this day I was driving, I had already gone to see her once that week. She said, maybe you should come back. So on my way back from work, I was listening to Tangled Up in Blue for the 47th time. That's never
that's good.
That's like
that's
the coconut
good.
Chocolate.
Yeah.
Things are bad.
Yeah.
Things are bad. In fact, your car, after playing Tangled Up in Blue like 10 times, I'll give you a limit of 15. It should just drive you right. It should just 5150 you. Your car should take you to the nut house.
They should put a chip in there. Yeah.
They should put a 5150 chip in your Bob Dylan CD.
Yeah.
And you're in because you've listened one too many times and you didn't cut in any other music.
Yeah.
So,
And you have to add to that chip Adele's Someone Like You, which I've listened to 40 times in the last month.
40
times. So how many times should the chip give you before it 5150s you on Adele?
It should have done it at the 10th time.
10th time?
It should have said, yeah, you know, everybody gets sad, but
this
ahead.
Is too much.
Yeah, but this is too much.
And as I'm driving over for my second therapy appointment in a week, having not slept and the kids sick and whatever, I felt my body just shaking, physically shaking, which I hadn't experienced before. I got there and she said you should have your husband probably pick you up. Probably shouldn't drive.
She could see you visibly shake.
Yeah. And this is a person I really trust who I've known a long time. And she said, you need a break. So, you know, having worked in radio and whatever, like I have my work ethic is something that's part of my identity. Mm-hmm. I think, well, I'm not that great at this job. I don't do anything special, but I show up on time. And I'm never sick. I never miss. I'm always there. So
why is it so hard for you to admit that you do a great job?
Because I don't.
That's
mediocre
bullshit.
At this.
Why would everybody continue to hire you?
Because the competition is not, the bar's low.
Teresa,
there's not that many women doing it.
You're great.
I listened to Beth Littleford on your show, yeah. And I thought, yeah, that's how it's supposed to be done. She's very articulate. And she's likable, and she's charming, and she's fun, and she knows when to shut up and when to talk.
So
I'm
are
not
you.
That.
You're crazy.
No.
You're crazy. I want to slap you. And that should be the other chip. The third chip in the car is when you hear a friend slap you, then it takes you.
Then it takes you right to 5150.
Yeah.
So there was discussion about what would be a good idea for me to do.
Yeah.
And she said, you got to take time off, which, again, I had never done.
You were
ever.
Doing this morning radio.
Yeah. And I took a week off just to be with my kid. You know, I felt horrible that I went to work and was not the first person he saw in the morning.
Can you back up for a second, too? And do you mind being more specific about the lengths you were considering going to?
Okay. All right. Well, I did call my dad because one of the things that was concerning me was that he was going to take it hard. Because we're still really close, even though he never bothered to molest me. So I'm really, really close to my dad.
Yeah.
So I thought, now that I'm a parent, I know that would be a horrible feeling. Because people would look at you with a stink eye. Mm-hmm. You're the guy whose daughter killed herself. Mm-hmm. And you probably were bad. Like, I knew it would be. But my dad is an incredibly sunny person. He could be sunny about stage 5 lung cancer, and there's only stage 4. You know what right. I mean? Like, he yeah. could make you feel better about anything. Right. So I called him, and I had already convinced myself that because he was so sunny that he'd be fine about it. Mm-hmm. But I just called, and I said, you know, I just want to go. What do you mean? Go where? He's my dad. You know, he knew. I said, I just want to go. I feel like Buster would be better without me. You know, Daniel will meet somebody else.
Buster's your nickname for your
yeah.
little boy.
He'll be better off without me. I'm not doing a good job. My husband will meet somebody else. I just, like, it hurts. I just want to go. I just want to leave. And then I said, I know he'll be fine. And he said, I'll never, ever be fine if you go. He got in his car and he came down here. Just, you know, a 12-hour drive. But it was weird to hear him say that. He just said, you're wrong. I'll never be fine. I'll never, ever be fine. And, you know, I talked to my therapist, and she said, I explained to her that I felt that Buster would be better off without me because I wasn't doing a good job. And she said, do you know what I did my graduate thesis in? Kids whose parents kill themselves. And he's not going to be fine. He's never going to be fine. So, you know, hearing that it sort of didn't really believe her that he'd be better with me than with, you know, whoever else my husband would marry after me. But you know, when I literally just needed 2 nights of sleep and to be with my child, because I think not being there when he woke up in the morning and being the person who changed his diaper and just being the first, like, I didn't feel like his mom. And, you know, it was a really weird transition for me. I didn't have postpartum, but there was something unreal about it. Like, I'd get in my car and see the car seat and I'd wonder, whose car is this? Like, why is there a baby seat in my car? You know, it didn't. And I thought, why do I feel this way? Why don't I feel natural? And obviously, you know, not obviously, but I think I was just freaked out that I was going to be, you know, like my mom. I was going to greet motherhood with a very weak handshake.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to like it. I wasn't going to be good at it. I wasn't going to be a natural. Like I thought, I think of it like basketball players, you know, like there are Michael Jordans. Those are naturals. And you see those moms. And then there are Derek Fishers. And, you know, they work hard in the off season. And they have hustle. And you want Derek Fisher. And then there's people that are just stiffs. You know what I mean? Mm. And I thought, you know, that because of the way I was raised and because my mom didn't like being a mom, that I, you know, I was just scared. And when I had a few days, the other thing is that my mom was living here to help with the baby. And I think having her around was...
She was or was not living?
She was here. Uh-huh. Because I would get up at 4:30 and leave, and she would come over every morning to help with the baby, which was very generous. But I think being around her all the time was deeply painful. Because she would say things like, well, we're just not naturals. About,
wow.
Yeah, and when she'd see me interact with my kid. And during that, after I had the incident,
yeah.
after the meltdown, she left. And I felt so much better just not seeing that woman every day. Like, God bless her for helping me. But it was very triggering seeing her every day and thinking that I was her. And when she left, I realized, holy fuck, I'm not her. I love being a mom. And I might fuck it up and I might make mistakes. But my child is going to see that when he walks into a room, I'm fucking happy to see him.
Yeah.
And I might screw it up or whatever, but I'm going to be here in the morning when he wakes up. Yeah. Maybe I'll be broke. Maybe we'll have to move to Koreatown. Maybe, as I said on Adam's show, maybe I'll work at Pinkberry, yeah. but I don't care. And, you know, I made a commitment to do that job for a year and I fulfilled it. So I stayed there another couple of months. Look, I stopped crying. Remember I said how I couldn't once I started, but I'm sorry about my nose running. It's totally gross. Anyway, so sorry for the sniffling, but, So I got some sleep. I spent, you know, a week plus the weekend. And I think I added a Monday or a Tuesday. Mm. So I spent about 10 days without my mom around, just being with my kid. And I realized I can do this. I'm doing this. I love my kid. I'm concerned about the job I'm doing. It's important to me. And that alone means I'm doing a good enough job. And I read a ton of books during that time that were really helpful. And one of them
Most of them were John Grisham novels, but they were still books.
The Firm, you'd be amazed.
Yeah, a lot of good mommying skills in there.
A lot of, like, how to do a timeout.
You just have to look at your child as the corporation.
Yes, exactly. And never, you know, don't lose when you're chasing it. I don't know. I'm trying to remember The Firm now. I can't make any jokes about The Firm. I read a lot of books, and one of them basically said, hover parents or parents who are too involved, that's actually bad for the kid. Here's what you want to go for. Good enough. You expose them to enough cultural things. You take them to enough of it. Like, good enough.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's right up my alley.
Yeah.
I can do that.
Yeah.
And then it was just a life-changing moment, but it had to get really extreme, and that's when it dawned on me, to come back to what you're saying about the human connection, that the only things I cared about, the things I thought I cared about, whether I was successful, whether I sold books, whether people liked me, whether people admired me, whether I was good at things, I suddenly couldn't have given a fuck about any of that, or whether I went to Trader Joe's today, or whether I did the laundry, or whether nothing fucking mattered. I just wanted to be with my husband and my kid, and that's it. And it's the kind of clarity that you can only, unfortunately, sometimes get from an extreme experience like that. But, you know, I had been Googling gun stores because I was stumped about how. Mm-hmm. And but I hadn't actually gone. Like, you have to fill out some forms and wait a week and take a class. And I don't think
I
would have done that. Did you?
Yeah. Yeah. I actually had applied for the license.
Did?
Yeah.
Did you go to the one in the Valley or downtown?
I did. It used to be B&B Guns on Oxnard.
Fucking dark. I can't believe we're going here.
Yeah.
So you went there.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to fire a gun, so I was going to take the class.
Yeah.
Did you take
I had a friend take me to the gun range. He didn't. And I don't think I even knew that that's where I was headed, but I was starting to hear voices in my backyard at night. And this was when I was drinking a lot also. This would have been
I was in your garbage looking for chocolates.
This was like 1999.
But I felt like there was, like the world was closing in on me, and I don't think I realized that, that's what I was trying to do. There was two thoughts in my head. One was that I need to kill myself to make this pain end, and right. The other was that people are going to invade my home and my backyard,
so
and I need to protect myself.
So you were having paranoid delusions.
Yeah, yeah, I think I was. I think I was, but I was also drinking a lot, and I was, my depression was unmedicated at that point.
Sleeping?
No problem sleeping. Actually, sleeping too much.
Oh, well, yeah, that's the other sign that you're depressed.
Yeah, but I just like to compare notes when I can. I like to.
I can't believe you went down there.
Too when I can.
And you filled out the form.
Filled out, yeah. In fact, I don't know if it's still valid, but yeah, I'm cleared. I got a permit to, you know. I took the course.
And then you're supposed to wait a week, which I think is a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know why I didn't buy one. I know my wife did not want me to buy one. She thought it was completely unnecessary. But we had somebody, a fugitive, run through our yard like a couple of years earlier, and it freaked both of us out. So I think in my mind, that was the reason why I was going to buy the gun. But deep down, I also had this fantasy every day that I'm going to kill myself to make this.
I found it very comforting. Like in that last week where I was Googling the gun shops and calling my dad, and where I sort of thought this is the way to go here. I suddenly felt better. I felt relieved. And I think that's common when people, I don't believe I was genuinely suicidal.
Right.
I believe that I was having these fantasies because they were a relief from the pressure I felt.
You need a plan B.
I needed a plan B. And I just, the idea that there, to me, the idea that I was, that I wasn't a good mother was, I just simply couldn't have it. Yeah. I just simply couldn't live with that. It was too much having had that experience myself. Like, and it was bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, I was doing fine. I am doing fine. There were professionals around who agreed that I was, more than that. Like, they said, you know, my kid goes to this amazing daycare as a woman. She's written a book. She's been doing it for 40 years. And she's like, this kid is so together. You don't have to worry about this. Like, but it wouldn't get in because I was paranoid.
Yes. And where there's mental illness, it doesn't matter sometimes what the external circumstances are, because the brain will twist it to be whatever fact the brain needs it to be to justify its own sickness.
I'll tell you what, there are days now, whatever, 4 or 5 months later, Paul, that a part of me misses that moment because it was so extreme. And I know I keep saying that, but...
Which moment?
Of just crashing and, you know, emailing my boss that I was going to have to take a week off. And, you know, it was almost like people knew.
So is this the moment before or after you knew that you needed time off?
When I took that time off
and,
you know, everything stopped, you know, and my therapist and my husband, you know, this was like a thing. People were worried. And, you know, we took steps and we addressed it. And sometimes I miss that because... there are times, even 4 or 5 months later, I find myself getting wrapped up in things that don't matter. And I miss that feeling that I knew that they didn't, you know, like if you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
like,
I so know
I
what
find
you
myself
mean.
Going, does Whitney Cummings have to have two fucking shows? Why? God, you know, like, and I've met her a couple times. She's really nice. And on a good day when everything's happening good and I like, and I'm a leaf in the stream and, you know, I'm in the matrix. Like, God bless. There's enough to go around and she's so hardworking and everything. And then, but then there are days where you go, why didn't I amount to anything? I mean, why, you know? And so when I have stupid thoughts like that, that creep in that are, that I know are meaningless, as I know like,
but look, they seem so real when they come in that it's, you have fucked up. You don't work hard enough.
Right.
You aren't good enough.
You aren't ambitious.
Yes. You aren't ambitious.
Yes.
And it feels so
real.
You
should have. You
fucked up.
Why
the world
you screw
is passing
up? Why did you
by.
Quit this or that job? You'd be here or there.
Yes.
You could have been. You would have been.
They're lies. They are lies. You know, sometimes I think that the universe, what feels like it's cornered us and we fucked up, is it's trying to give us something that we really needed. Now, your book sale... if your book had been a bestseller, it would have just delayed, I think, the inevitable of you having to have this moment of you realizing what was important.
I agree. I mean, I think there was so, writing that book, there were a confluence of events, you know, like water flowing into one big river that right. led to this. But writing the book was so hard because I had an infant at the time who I was nursing. So I won't bore you with that, but it was very hard and exhausting. And then working and then promoting the book. So going on Dr. Phil and the talk and they're all over. And there was so much blood, sweat, and tears. And it was the first time in my life as a writer that it didn't come back to me. You know, like in my show business career, whatever, on TV, some things are good, some things are bad, some things fail, whatever. But as a writer, every time I had written something, and, you know, I don't aim that high, right. but people had felt it on some level, and it had been received well. And you know, this was received well, but it wasn't a bestseller. So right. I think putting all that effort and energy into it, and it not being, you know, like a huge, and you know, it will earn out its advance, which 1 in 10 books right. do. So there's that, but that wasn't enough. And I do think, yes, had I gotten that, would that have made it all better? No, because the thing that I had to do, I think, was not get up at 4:30 in the morning. It's just that simple. And people who work weird hours know what I'm talking about, because it really screws up your brain until you cannot fucking tolerate any stressor.
Yeah.
You know, until you can't think straight, and then you're Googling the gun ranges. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the valley, maybe I'll just be alive. But right after that, I went back to work, and there was a news story about these suicide kits. Where you, I don't know, I should feel like I'm worried about, if you're suicidal, that's, don't, because look, I'm honest, I cried and shit, but I've never been fucking happier. I've never been happier in my life because for the most part, I'm still pretty clear that these human connections I have are all that matters.
Yeah.
And I'm so lucky to have them. So fuck everything else. Whatever. But there are kits.
Yeah.
I found out. This is what I was getting to. So after that whole gun debacle where I couldn't figure out how to get a fucking gun, and I really honestly do not feel like I was legitimately suicidal. I feel like I was fantasizing. Yeah. But I was down. These kits, okay, this old lady was selling them online, and I think she was getting prosecuted. It had to do with like a helium balloon. Did you hear about this? It's like some kind of helium balloon set up, and you know, that she was helping people to gently pass onto the next life, shuffle off their mortal coils. And I thought,
with a cartoony voice.
Now, well, this is my favorite. Okay, so now you're trying to say your last. Maybe you're alone, but then don't you think you say something just to hear yourself with the cartoony voice?
Yeah. Why? I don't understand. What is the purpose of the helium balloon?
Somehow it kills you. There must be some kind of...
You just inhale helium?
You know, like the plastic bag thing where you get... My aunt did that, and they found there are a lot of suicides in my family, and my aunt...
Apparently she wasn't an environmentalist. She chose paper.
She was wasted... The bag. I hope they recycled and somebody else killed themselves with it. You know what's funny? Yeah. Her husband also killed himself later.
That's awful.
It's not funny.
Yeah.
But he didn't use the same bag. And I feel like, hey, carbon footprint, guys.
Yeah.
You know what you could have used? But she had the book next to her after she was found, Final Exit. And it explains that the plastic bag is best thing. So this helium balloon thing must be some version of suffocating yourself, but it involves helium.
Yeah.
And I do like to imagine that it's goodbye, girl. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But now I think maybe the ways to kill yourself shouldn't be readily available because...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in a capitalistic democracy, it should, but in many ways it shouldn't be.
I do think, right, I believe strongly that if you are ill... And you would like to go, that you should be allowed to do that with dignity.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you've got some life-threatening illness and you're in pain.
Do you think if you're depressed, you should be allowed to just go with dignity?
I don't. Well, I think you should be allowed to do whatever it is that you want to do. I'm a libertarian that way. But I think most people, I think 99.9% of the people would be wrong in
it's
making
going
that
to pass.
Snap judgment.
It's going
it
to pass.
It is going to pass. Yeah. It is going to pass.
But what if you've been depressed for like 10 years?
I was depressed for 10 years. And
it passed.
It passed. Sometimes it comes back. It's settled over me for the last couple of months. I'm working
Where
on
are you
changing,
today?
Changing my meds.
10 being I'm at the gun range, mm-hmm. getting, because you already filled out the paperwork, and 1 is you're Whitney Cummings, because I just imagine you'd be really, really happy.
I'm probably a 5 or a 6. Just everything is gray, everything is flat. I know it's going to change. I'm just impatient and I'm just
what can I do to make it better?
Doing this podcast that I'm telling you, this podcast, people tell me I love the podcast, it makes me feel less alone, makes me feel less fucked up. I say it all the time, this does it for me. That moment when you said your dad, you were crying and you said, my dad said I will never be okay with it, I felt something in me lift, and I just felt like there's somebody out there that gets me, that I get, that it's okay for me to talk about my pain. It's okay for me to say that I'm afraid. I'm afraid that I'm never going to be happy and have passion like I used to. That's a big fear of mine, 'cause it's been months since I felt any passion for anything.
Even about doing this podcast?
I have moments when I'm doing this podcast. Most of the time I'm just sweating and nervous that I'm doing a whole lot. My shirt is almost completely soaked through.
You know what I find really helps? Mounds Bar.
Yeah?
Yeah, or Twix.
I had a big bowl of, they did a premiere party for the show that my wife works on, and they had it catered, and it was this amazing caterer. It was this bowl of that hot chocolate lava-y cake,
yes,
with ginger ice cream.
Oh my god!
And that was like 10
well,
minutes
I don't
of
fuck
just
around
bliss.
With no ginger in my shit, yeah, though. Don't put ginger in my fucking dessert.
It was good.
No.
There was chunks of ginger in it.
No,
it was good.
No, that's all wrong. But I like the lava, yeah, chocolate cake. I have not had candy, cake, yeah, ice cream, nothing 10 years. Don't miss it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah, don't miss it. Because it wasn't like one Jolly Rancher. It was, I'm going to keep a bag of Jolly Ranchers under my bed because that's going to be my boyfriend and my friend.
That's what we call getting into the ranching business. Do you feel like doing a fear off?
Yeah.
Do we have time?
Oh, yes.
You okay on time?
Yes. Okay. I'm
so,
my computer.
I am so happy that you found time to come do this, because I know you're super crazy busy, but I think a lot of people are going to really get a lot.
I hope so. Well, obviously, you know what we'll do after the fear off, maybe before we sign off? You know what I'm going to do?
What?
You tell me. Maybe we can both do this. What? Since we both like to regret things we've said or failed to say,
yes,
let's take a moment.
Let's do that.
And we'll address our regrets.
Off. A regret off.
Yes. And then
Teresa
that way,
Strasser.
We leave, we're clean.
I like
right?
it.
Right?
I like it. Okay.
Okay.
I am going to listeners' fears, because as I've said on the podcast,
Jesus,
many
you're
times,
out of fears?
I've done over like 120 on the
right.
show.
You're and right.
I don't
getting...
and I don't want to repeat
right.
some. And I like the listeners being a part of the show. So this one comes from I'm gonna withhold her name because it's a very identifiable name. I don't know if she wants this to be anonymous or not, but it says, here are some fears from a 42-year-old woman in Minnesota.
I'm facing off against somebody in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Oh, honey.
And then
uh-oh.
She's...
Oh. Look out.
Oh, she's crushed, huh?
I think so.
All right.
Yeah.
Her first fear is, I fear that I won't ever look good in clothes again.
I'm afraid that because my mother left at a critical age, I will never truly feel safe or happy. In your face.
That's good. That is good. I fear that SSRIs have killed my ability to orgasm forever.
I'm afraid that I harp on my crappy childhood too often and that it really wasn't that bad.
And by the way, we don't stop to say how crazy and unjustified your fears are, but just know that 99.9% of them, percent of them are fucking crazy and unjustified. I'm just not going to stop and address all those. She says, I fear I won't ever sleep through the night again. It's 2 years and counting with insomnia. I thought you'd enjoy that one.
Oh, I do. I'm afraid I repeat myself and annoy people.
Mm-hmm. I fear I'll keep getting fatter despite more than 7 hours of exercise per week, at least 1 hour per day for at least 5 days.
I'm afraid I say the same thing over and over.
I fear I'm older and crustier than my years.
I'm afraid that one day the things about me my husband finds charming, he will find unbearably grating.
I fear I'm becoming irrelevant.
I'm afraid of being one missed thank you note or elbow on the table away from being Jodie Foster in the movie Nell.
Oh, God, I love you. I fear I'm the only one who craves attention in person, face to face, without keyboards in the age of smartphones.
I'm afraid I will always be faking social graces instead of organically manifesting them.
I fear that I'm losing my mind.
I'm scared the people who think I'm talented will all, one by one, realize that they overestimated me.
I fear that I'm the only one who seems to care about copy editing. That's a very specific one she has.
God, I'm slowly falling in love with this lady.
Yeah, she's great.
Her fears really paint a picture of somebody I would like.
Yeah.
I'm scared of being broke and having to go back to living in Koreatown and having only one bathroom.
I fear I'm the only one I work with who writes things down.
I'm scared the veins under my eyes are becoming visible and making me look old.
They're not, by the way. I fear I'll be old, alone, and mumbling to myself when my kids pass me by.
I'm scared that one especially vitriolic and dedicated internet troll will follow me in my career, posting nasty shit about me until the day the only thing I'm writing is my will, and the only thing I'm hosting is bingo night at the old folks' home.
Oh, God damn it, you are good. I mean, you should literally come through saloon doors with the fear off. I mean, you are so fucking good. All right, you've already outlasted one listener, so I'm bringing in another listener
okay.
now. So you've already killed one off.
All right, I'm telling.
We're going to Kayla now.
You got to double team me.
Yeah, we're going to Kayla, who says, my biggest fear is falling and knocking my teeth out.
I'm scared my son has inherited one of my worst traits, being emotionally volatile.
I have a fear of hitting an animal when I drive at night.
I'm scared of even voicing any real fears about my son because they are so scary that it makes me superstitious. But suffice to say, I'm terrified of getting any sort of call about bad news from daycare or any other health crisis.
Good God. I fear that germs at the Red Box. I don't know. What is the Red Box?
That's where you get DVDs for $1 from the Albertsons. I'm classy.
Okay, all right.
I'm scared of seeing my child's blood even from a skinned knee.
I fear losing a loved one.
I'm scared my child will be a social outcast because I was a social outcast and I won't be able to show him the secret world of how popular people interact.
I fear that I will come home one day and my cat will be dead.
I'm scared that my features are harsh and make me look angry or mean and that this will prevent me from continuing to work in television.
God damn it, you are so good. And by good, I mean crazy. I have a fear of getting fat and no one will think I'm attractive.
I'm scared I'll never be important in any public way.
I'm afraid that I will be stuck at my desk job for the rest of my life and never have a career where I'm satisfied.
I'm scared I will never stop grade grubbing from the pass-fail class that is life.
I have a fear of finding God.
I'm scared I wear too much makeup.
I fear the unknown.
I'm scared many of my skirts and shorts are too short.
Wow, you have now knocked off a second listener.
What? Triple team.
We're getting to my last. I'm running out. This is my last listener that I brought.
I'm just getting warmed up.
Now we're going into Robert's fears. I'm afraid my therapist will die suddenly. I'll never find another one with his skill and understanding regarding the baggage I have, and I'll end up stuck, never growing and unwinding again as I started to when he was there for me.
I'm scared people will realize I've been lying about my height for years.
I'm afraid my stress will eventually give me cancer and end my life early.
I'm scared that my mom will kill herself.
I'm afraid I'll get a stroke when I'm older and not be able to get an assisted suicide. My last years will go on painfully, incapacitatedly, with my brain barely there and my life a huge drain emotionally and, turning page, emotionally and financially on my family.
I'm scared my dad will keep riding his bicycle despite his terrible eye spasms and crash his bike. And I'm also terrified to have voiced this concern out loud because God might punish me even though I'm not sure my conception of God includes this kind of punitive bullshit.
Oh my, I am in the presence of a master.
Listen, anxiety is to me what the 100 meter is to Usain Bolt. I own it.
I'm in the presence of greatness. Robert says, I'm afraid humans have shifted to the and he's pretty fucking good,
he's
too,
good.
I have to say.
And so is Minnesota.
Yeah.
Fats, Robert, I like to call her. Robert. Sorry, go ahead.
Robert says, I'm afraid humans have shifted to the unconscious goal of mastering and dominating nature rather than living in harmony with it, and it's made us more of a cancer to Earth than a healthy presence, and before we get a chance to change, civilization will kill its host with human life as we know it plummeting from the face of the Earth a whole lot faster than we ever realized was possible.
Well, this is germane to his fear. I'm scared that as a writer, I will never quite get to the point and say exactly what I mean.
That's good. But I can tell you from your book that couldn't be more wrong. Your book has so many great, great insights and very eloquently phrased. Everything else you did in life is shit, but that is...
that is my one moment.
Robert says, I'm afraid of being alone.
I'm scared I won't have another child and my son will have no one to play with but me and drive me nuts.
I'm deathly afraid of getting a kidney stone.
I'm scared that in those moments that parenting isn't totally joyful, my son will somehow sense I want to be elsewhere.
You have won, Teresa Strasser. You defeated three listeners.
I have like 10 more.
Do you really?
You want to hear them?
Yeah.
I'll go through them quickly.
Let's go and boom, boom, boom.
I'm scared I will outlive my husband. I'm scared I won't be able to afford private school or that I'll pick out the wrong one and that my son will either be a gangbanger or worse, some Waldorf school kid who discovers fractions through the majesty of shape toys and expresses his feelings through trumpet solos. I'm afraid of using a word incorrectly and looking stupid. I'm afraid of always looking just a little bit pregnant. I'm afraid of getting the same outer thigh spread that is common to all of my aunts. I'm afraid that I only understand what's truly important in life when I have extreme life or death experiences. I'm afraid that all of my epiphanies are Teflon. They don't stick and they never will. I'm afraid I will text or check email with the baby in the car and have an accident, and police records will show that I was deleting an email from Target.com when I was T-boned by an 18-wheeler. I'm afraid other moms look at me with my son and think, what the fuck is she doing? Something doesn't seem right. I'm afraid that being really, truly wildly rich is actually super amazing, but I will never know. I'm afraid that I don't know how to maintain my friendships with women very well. I'm scared that I'll never be able to sleep like a normal person without any kind of medication. I'm afraid my brother's cancer will come back or that he is suffering quietly with the symptoms he has and not saying anything. I'm afraid my mother will die without ever seeing my child again because she is so stubborn and I am so resentful. I'm afraid I share too much but don't do it with enough finesse or lyricism to make it worthwhile. Last one. I'm afraid my bangs were a bad idea. Went for Zooey Deschanel, got Dumb and Dumber.
Teresa fucking Strasser. Wow. Wow.
I thought you were going to bring it a little harder with the fears.
You know what? I underestimated you.
But I stopped here at 46, but I could keep going.
Yeah.
This is my distance. Remember when Usain Bolt was running and he took the time to look back? Taking fractions of us, like adding, and he was like, I don't fucking care because I'm so fucking fast.
Yeah.
I can stop and turn around. And you know what? Maybe I'll even like give a peace sign or something. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Because he could spare it.
Yeah.
That.
You probably could have riffed on fears while getting a massage.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah.
No, like doing something completely relaxing.
Yeah.
I could be on 9 Xanax and still, in the pit of my stomach, could find a little butterfly.
Yeah. Wow, that was... you want to go out? Let's fade out on a regret off.
Yeah, things that we will regret. So we don't have to worry after this.
Yes. I will kick it off. I regret that I injected too much of myself into the podcast.
Oh, my God, that's the best. Yeah, I kind of... regret that I didn't let you talk enough and didn't follow up enough on things you said.
I regret that I will get in the car and realize that I forgot to ask you a question that I absolutely wanted to ask you.
Shit, should we do a bonus where you ask me that one question? Is there actually specific?
No,
oh, just in general
isn't.
That it'll
yes,
pop.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
That's a fear more
that's
than
what,
a regret.
That's more of a fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I regret... a lot of times lately, since actually I had this before having a kid, but I think it's because of maybe the Klonopin I take to help me sleep. Mm-hmm. When I'm grabbing for a word, when I'm writing, I don't have a problem, but when I'm speaking, I don't often grab the right word. It's mm-hmm. like I'm on the monkey bars and I miss it. Mm-hmm. So I regret that I stumble for word. I'm going to regret, mm-hmm. but not anymore because I'm saying it. Right. I stumbled a little today.
I didn't feel that. I don't have any more regrets.
I don't either. You'd think that I would regret crying and shit, but I think it's okay.
I was really touched by that. I was really, really touched. I mean, I'm glad. Here's a non-regret. I'm glad I didn't fuck it up by saying anything. Because I wanted to, part of me wanted to, when you were crying, I don't know, I felt like I wanted to say something. I don't know what it was that I wanted to say, but I was just so, just moved, just completely moved. The vulnerability when people come on this show and they open up in a really deep, honest, vulnerable way, it is like that feeling you described when you suddenly realized where your priorities were and you felt like you were vibrating at the frequency you're meant to be vibrating at. That moment when you were crying, I just felt that, just that this is exactly where I'm supposed to be in the universe. And that to me, life is, I'm just trying to string as many moments together where I don't question where I am and what I've done. And this last hour and a half, this may sound cheesy, this is an hour and a half where I absolutely know this is where I was supposed to be. You were supposed to be my guest, and everything that happened was exactly as it should be, and it just, I feel great.
Thank you for having me.
Teresa Stresser. That's your new name. Thanks again to Teresa Strasser for that great interview. Thanks to my wife, Carla, for all her support and feedback on the show. Thank you guys for the feedback you give me through the website. Thanks for the emails. And thanks to the guys that help keep the spammers out of the forum. And just remember, if you're stuck, you're not a piece of shit. The world is not passing you by. And I hope that you can string some moments together where you don't question where you are and feel okay with whatever is happening in your life. You are not alone. Thanks for listening.